The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
If you are looking for life and career enhancements, you need experts that have been there, done that, tried, sometimes failed, and ultimately succeeded. Welcome to The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. You may be looking for help with relationships, health and wellness, home life, career, finance, or faith. We hopefully have the answers you are seeking. Now, here is your host, Scott Ventrella.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella, and today I'd like to focus on patriotism. We're just a few weeks past Memorial Day. The 4th is upon us, the 4th of July. Now, I know I'm going to sound probably a little old-fashioned here. I was brought up in the raised in the 1960s. My dad was a World War II veteran. He joined the Army Air Corps, lied about his age, went in when he was 16 years old. A lot of guys did that back then. You know, they wanted adventure and excitement and all that good stuff. Well, he was shipped off to the Pacific Theater, specifically Okinawa. I mention that because, both my dad and many of his friends who also served in World War II, patriotism was extremely important to them, and he instilled that. I'm one of seven kids, especially in the boys, I would say. But, you know, we would go to sporting events, and when they played the anthem, if we had a hat on, it's hat off, hand over heart. It was a very somber, solemn, respectful, behavior, whether it be with the flag or with an anthem, etc. We hung our flags on Memorial Day and 4th of July and, all the major patriotic holidays, let's say. It just seems that as I've gotten older and I attend, whether it be a Memorial Day parade or a sporting event, I don't observe the same level of respect. I'm not sure about you and what your experiences have been. And again, I understand I'm from a different generation, but we are still, as everybody knows, we still have men and women, that are in conflict, that are fighting wars, that are being maimed, injured, and killed, to this day. And I guess it also bothers me a little bit when I'm at a sporting event and you see, whether it be the athletes or people in the stands, some people show the proper respect. Other people, that you see them chatting, they're not really paying attention. I think, unfortunately, much has been lost. There may be a lot of different reasons for that. I don't know exactly what the reason might be. I know certainly there are very strong feelings today about the wars that we're fighting, specifically now in Iraq, Afghanistan, and spotty few other places. I'd like to focus though on, and regardless of what your views may be on the conflicts, on the wars, and war in general. I would like to talk a little bit about that. I think we do throw around the term very loosely when we talk about people that are here are the heroes that we look up to, people who demonstrate tremendous acts of bravery and courage, and obviously the ultimate heroism are those that have laid down their lives. It's been said, as you know, that there's no greater love than to lay down your life for another. During President Lincoln's Gettysburg Address back in 1863, and I'm just quoting in part He goes on to say, the world will little note nor long remember what we say here, which obviously, you know, he was wrong about that, because here we are over 100 years, 150 years plus, and we do remember. But anyway, continuing with the quote, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. About 5 years later, in 1868, what was known as Decoration Day was established, now, of course, known as Memorial Day. For today's show, I am pleased and honored to have a very special guest. His name is Brandon Webb. Brandon Webb is a former U.S. Navy SEAL. He is an author, digital media entrepreneur, special operations subject matter expert, and CEO of Force 12 Media. He also is the author of the just-out book, Among Heroes, U.S. Navy SEAL's True Story of Friendship, Heroism, and the Ultimate Sacrifice. Brandon, thank you for being on the show. It's a privilege to have you.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Glad to be here.
So, Brandon, I'm not sure if you caught part of my introduction. Is it just my imagination, or does it seem that, you know, people maybe have forgotten and maybe so far removed, you know, if you haven't been up front and close, it seems that some people just have got, it's lost on people the sacrifice that so many have made. What are your impressions?
And I guess my impressions as a veteran, and, you know, I served from 1993 to 2006 under, you know, the Clinton administration and the Bush administration. And I think after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, I saw a lot of support. Like the mood seemed to change in America. There was a tremendous amount of support for the troops from, you know, regardless of what political party you're affiliated with. I felt like people were more supportive of the troops, but then you get into the stuff that you talked about as far as, you know, being respectful during the national anthem and removing the hats and stuff like that. It does seem like there's a decline of just awareness and respect for that type of activity. But I think on a whole, you know, we've gone through a couple different changes. You know, you talk about World War II. I think everybody was really clear on what we're doing in World War II and what we're trying to accomplish. You know, Vietnam, not so much, not very popular. The veterans coming home from Vietnam did not get a very good reception whatsoever. I'm just thankful that, you know, my generation who went after those Twin Towers fell in New York, went overseas, that we're coming back to a much better reception at home as far as the, you know, people are concerned. I'll leave the lack of care at the Veterans Affairs Department maybe for another conversation, but
okay,
that's probably a little bit longer answer than you wanted, but
your
question.
I did not serve. The Vietnam had just ended. If I recall, it was like 1975. If it had gone on a few more years, I likely would have been drafted. I think for me, the greatest influence was my dad, who instilled that in us. And you know, he didn't tell a lot of stories, but he talked about, you know, these big burly guys and Marines that he would meet that really saw serious action, when they got home, they literally would kiss the ground, you know, big burly guys that would just break down crying and so just hearing those stories. And my dad did not see, he was not in direct battles. He was more, you know, behind the scenes, but he did experience a lot of the aftermath. It was more of, and we certainly had cousins, uncles that fought in that war. Some did not make it back. My point is, even though I did not serve, that made a big impression on both myself and I would say the rest of our family. I don't think others might have that same opportunity. You're absolutely right about the Vietnam War. They did get a bad rap. Again, no matter what people think about Vietnam and why we went there and the outcome, you know, the people who served, the people who gave their lives, you know, they did it with a feeling of, you know, serving the country and believing what they were doing was for, you know, noble purpose. I'd like to get a feel. Go back to 1993. Whatever prompted you to join the Navy and specifically become a U.S. Navy SEAL? As I understand it, you were only one of out of 200. Only 23 made it through that. What prompted you to join up?
Sure. So I grew up as a kid working on boats, and I got my first job working on a scuba diving boat out of Ventura Harbor, which is off the coast of Central California. And, so I grew up on the boat, you know, at 13 years old, got certified to scuba dive, and worked that boat, you know, through high school. And my parents were always had this dream to sail around the world, so they ended up taking my sister and I on our 50-foot catch called Agio. Right before my 16th birthday, we were planning this big round the world trip. So, at that time in my life, I had a lot of independence. I had a great job. I really wasn't too keen on leaving my friends and going on this trip. So I did go. We left in California, sailed through Mexico all the way down to Acapulco over to the Marquesas Islands, French Tuamotos, and then we got to Papeete, Tahiti, and my dad threw me off the boat when I was 16. He was like, him and I, we were just arguing about everything seamanship related, you know, what anchor to use on the bow and the stern, and you know, and I had to be honest and fair, I had a chip on my shoulder, and my, you know, my mother, we laugh about it today because she says, you know, looking back, she's like, you actually had a tremendous amount of boating experience, probably more than your own father, and we're right a lot of the times. But the problem was that you could only have one captain on the ship, so that's a that's an important
that's right.
leadership lesson I learned at 16. There can be only one captain. And so I left home at 16 in the South Pacific and found my way. I found a catamaran that needed crew that was sailing back to Hawaii. And I had finished my junior year early, sailed back to Hawaii, flew back to California, got my job back. The owner of the boat actually let me live and work on the boat. And I was really, you know, I was prepping to take my 100 tons master's captain's license and become a captain of one of the captains on this boat. But I just, you know, I felt I'd always had this thing about the military and wanting to join. I can't explain where it comes from. But then I had a chance to meet a couple Navy SEALs that were up just doing some recreational diving, and they kind of just gave me the spiel, and then I read Marcinko's book Rogue Warrior. Dick Marcinko is one of the founders of SEAL Team 6, and I was hooked. I just said, you know what, this is for me. You know, I had some of my friends outside of the boat that I was working on and in school, you know, getting into drugs, and I just, you know, I didn't have money for college and my grades were okay. So I just said, you know what, here's a challenge. I'm going to join the Navy and really, you know, serve the country, but also challenge myself personally and try and complete one of the toughest courses that probably the world's military has to offer. And that's the SEAL selection course, which we call BUD, for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training.
So walk us through what that, you know, we've seen the movies, and sometimes you watch it and think, do they really do some of those things? During the training, it looks like, you know, and then when you look at the numbers, how many people do not make it, and I'm sure it's both physical and, mental, psychological. What was that like for you? What's a day in the life of a training day?
Sure. So the course is split up into four phases, over about 7 months. And that's just, people have to understand that's just a selection process. So you got to finish this 7 month selections and then you can actually start doing, the real kind of SEAL training. Then you're, training begins, but the first phase is it's a pre-training phase where they kind of get you conditioned to go into first phase, which is what they call a conditioning phase, which is mostly physical in nature. And an average day of first phase would be up at 4 a.m. get your room ready for inspection later that day. So you got to clean everything up. Muster on the beach at 4:45, and then you're going to do probably a 2-hour PT session with, on the beach thrown in with a little what we call surf torture. I think they call it surf conditioning on the schedule. We call it surf torture. They basically lie the class down in the Pacific, and they have a chart, and they see how long they can take you right to the edge of hypothermia. And so it's 5:20 in the morning and you're in the cold Pacific, and most of the guys quit because they can't handle the cold water. And it really is just a mental game. And you're cold, and then you're getting out of the water and you're getting, beaten up on the physical conditioning stuff. Then after that, you'll run about 3 miles to eat breakfast. You eat breakfast, you run 3 miles back. Then you do maybe a timed obstacle course, you do the obstacle course, some classroom stuff, go run, 3 miles to lunch, 3 miles back. Then you're going to go do maybe a 2-mile timed ocean swim. And these things are timed and they drop every week. So if you're not meeting the standards, and you fail more than two, I think it's two timed events, you can be tossed out of training.
Now, do people self-select out, or are they selected out? Is it a voluntary thing?
Mostly, it's people are quitting themselves. So it's officially called a DOR or drop on request. And the tradition in BUDS is you have these different colored helmets depending on what phase you're in. In the first phase, it's a green helmet with your number, class number. In my case, it was 215. And then you'd ring that bell 3 times, put your helmet under the bell and your name under, so your helmet and your name is stenciled on there. And, about 2 weeks into first phase, there's a lot of helmets lined up there and you're looking down at a lot of them who were, eating breakfast or lunch next to you the day before. So it's a pretty humbling experience, but also, for me, it was just motivation seeing so many. I remember for me, I checked in really not in the best of shape, and I paid for it dearly. I was,
right.
I was singled out and, over 200 guys. We have a saying, you don't want to be, quote unquote, that guy. And that guy was me for first phase. It was brutal.
I want to come back to this. We're going to take a brief break. We're here with Brandon Webb, former U.S. Navy SEAL and author of several books, but his current book is Among Heroes, U.S. Navy SEAL's True Story of Friendship, Heroism, and the Ultimate Sacrifice. We'll be right back right after these messages.
Mm-hmm.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
The latest business information is made simple with the Voice America Business Network. The professionals in the business world bring you live talk radio shows featuring an array of business topics, strategies for building wealth, sales and marketing, stock trading, investing, and business technology. Voice America business hosts are professionals in their fields and bring to the airwaves weekly business discussions that offer up-to-date information, advice, and education. The Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business talk.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
This is The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. To reach the show today, call in to 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to scott@thebusinessofliving.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. And Brandon, so was there a time when you were tempted to ring that bell three times? Did you ever even come close?
To be completely honest, it didn't enter into my head one time. And I've had friends that I went through training with where, you know, they admitted, like, they thought they were on the brink at certain times. But for me, I just knew I was going to either make it or they're going to have to take me out of there in a body bag. And they put me through hell. And literally the last part of the first phase of the physical conditioning training is called Hell Week, where they keep you up with no sleep for 5.5 days straight. And I remember before starting Hell Week getting pulled aside by four instructors. Now, fast forward 10 years, and I'm an instructor now, I can look back and go, wow, they were trying to just railroad me out of the program and get me to quit. So, you know, these four instructors before Hell Week pulled me aside on the beach and just tried to get rid of me. They were just like, you don't belong here. Go back to the regular Navy. And I remember just, you know, looking at one of the meanest instructors and just telling him what I just told you. It's like, the only way you're getting me out of here is in a body bag. And they finally, it was a turning point for me. Mm-hmm. They started leaving me alone. And by that point I had kind of got myself into the shape I should have been before I showed up for training.
Right.
Not once did it enter my mind.
Now, did they prepare you, in addition to that type of training, did they prepare you for the possibility of being captured by the enemy, tortured? Do you receive any training along those lines?
Yeah, we do. So every SEAL or high risk, if you're in a high risk job and you have a security clearance, chances are you're going to go to a school that we call SEER school. It stands for Survive, Evade, Rescape, and Evade. What is it? Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. Mm-hmm. And it's really a part survival training, part prisoner of war training, where you're actually end up in a mock prisoner of war camp and an environment, and it is very, very real. I remember the guy next to me who was in a some type of intelligence program, he lost his mind the last day we're in this camp. He just literally thought he was never getting out of there.
Is it more mentally or is there physical? Because I would imagine, again, given that it's this is training, they have to make it maybe as simulate it as close to the real experience. But obviously, they're not going to bring you close to death.
It's both. I remember getting smacked around, open hand, smacks to the face. I remember also getting shoved into a very small box for about 45 minutes. And I've never had a problem with small spaces, but that I was having issues in that box.
Forget it. I would give them whatever they wanted. That's why I can never do that. Yeah, I'm a severe claustrophobic. Whatever you want to know, you got it. So it's good thing that, I do what I do. they could twist my little pinky back and I'd probably give it all up. So you guys are conditioned for that, the possibility. Obviously, no one wants that, but it does happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And an example of kind of what they teach us, I remember, so when you go, when we were captured and sent to this mock prison camp, they had you sign in and they said, hey, sign, what do you want for dinner? Do you want the chicken or the fish? And so people are walking up signing these things. Well, later they videotaped that and they created a propaganda video that showed the Americans confessing to war crimes. So it's those little things that you don't think about that really, that you have to think about. And they teach you how to, adapt and overcome those situations and how can you, survive, with dignity, but still not be used for propaganda or give them just enough information to keep yourself alive, but not necessarily, give away the complete secret. So they do a great job. They do a great job in that course. And
so 1993 again, check me on my memory. That was just post the first Gulf War. Is that correct? It wasn't the first Gulf War around 91 or so?
Correct.
Okay, so by that time, first Gulf War is over. Where were you deployed?
I started my career. I joined the Navy to be a SEAL, but I ended up starting my career as a search and rescue swimmer in helicopters. I was an airborne systems operator in H-60 helicopters, and then after a few years in the regular fleet, I finally got my package approved for BUDS. When I was graduating, you got to fill out your dream sheet. And at the time, there were only two teams that were really kind of known for doing real world work. Cause at the time there was relatively not much happening. And this would have been in like 1997, 98. And so the two teams were Team 4, which was doing a lot of work in South America. And then there was Team 3, which is doing a lot of work in Southwest Asia, really enforcing the UN sanctions against Saddam and Iraq. So we were doing a lot of non-compliant shipboardings, and doing a lot of work in the Middle East. So I put Team 3 down because I wanted to work. I wanted to, see some action and get out there and experience things. So fortunately, I got Team 3. And I did my first deployment, and then I remember getting a call, and we were on and off the ships up in the northern Arabian Gulf, and the USS Cole got hit in Aden, Yemen.
Oh yeah, I remember that well. Sure.
So we were flown down and put on the Cole as a emergency response team. We had a perimeter set around the boat in the port of Aden, and I was one of the snipers. We had a sniper team on the bridge, and we're told, if anybody or anything comes within 500 meters of the vessel, you're cleared to engage it, because they had blown a big hole in the side of the ship, and it was close to sinking pier side two or three times. They were working around the clock to not only pump out the bilge, but also recover the bodies of the crew. I think 17 was the number of total sailors killed. So it was kind of a wake-up call for me because, interacting with the crew who were very shell-shocked, they just lost, a bunch of their friends and shipmates. I was asking them, like, what was your security posture? Because I even remember there was a report of a failed attack, I think not even a year later or a year previous to that. And I was asking the security on the ship, I said, what was the defensive posture? And they said, well, we had guns and we were manning the rails, but the guns weren't loaded and most of us don't know how to shoot them.
Mm.
And it just showed me how here's this, $100 million plus warship that was almost sunk and put out of commission by two terrorists in a cheap boat with a bunch of explosives.
Yeah.
And how ill prepared we were to deal with the what was showing up to me as a modern day threat. You have this very, an enemy, and we're talking about, these radical Islamic terrorists that they don't have any defined border. They don't have, a set playbook, and we're really not prepared to deal with the situation. And I think it was a pivot point in the U.S. military where the conventional leadership started thinking, wow, like we really have to, we have to figure this out. And the pivot point was the fact that, especially after 9/11, which was a year later, the special operations community had always been in a supportive role of conventional forces, and it now found itself at the center of everything because it was the most relevant fighting force, and everything flipped, and now you had conventional aircraft carriers, submarines supporting small teams of special operations. So it was a real turning point in the U.S. Department of Defense during that period. And I found myself a year later watching the second plane hit the second tower. And a few months, not even a few months, I'd say a few weeks, I was over in Afghanistan back, right after 9/11.
I can't even imagine. Well, I live an hour from New York City. We lost like everybody within an hour or so of New York City. Everybody knows somebody directly or indirectly that was lost. We lost two from my small town alone. One, a young man who had just started his job with a financial services firm. But it definitely got everybody's attention. Now, next thing you know, you're in Afghanistan. And like you said at the beginning of the show, there was total support, bipartisan support at that time. It really did unify the country. And by the way, parenthetically, when I talk about the flags that you hardly ever see anymore on Memorial Day, especially in 4th of July, I'll never forget, that afternoon. A couple of my buddies were working down in the city. They actually saw the buildings fall. I was teaching at Fordham University in the city. Some of my students were in the building at that time. But I remember when we all got back, during the next couple of days, it was amazing to see the number of flags. I would say 80% of the houses in my neighborhood had flags that you'd never seen before. So it did. It seemed to rally people together. Now, you're in Afghanistan. Are you there as a SEAL, but you also were trained as a sniper? And as I understand it, one of your last assignments was as a course manager for the Elite SEAL Sniper Course.
Yeah.
So were you in Afghanistan as a sniper?
Was that your... I was. Most of the work that we did were more like direct action missions where we're going and hunting high value targets. And as a sniper, I did a lot of reconnaissance. So we would go. We'd sometimes work in pairs and go out and patrol at night and mark enemy locations. And we'd mark 10 or 12 on the night, and then you know, right before the pre-dawn, we'd work with our Air Force Special Operations brothers, the combat controllers, who were assigned to our SEAL platoon, and then we would systematically call in airstrikes on all those positions that me and my other sniper would identify. So we did a lot of that kind of work, a lot different mission than, say, what people think or when they see that movie American Sniper, where it's more urban and up close. You know, in Afghanistan, it was we learned really quick. The last thing you want to do is get in a firefight in that kind of terrain. So a lot of what we would do is just, you know, sneak around the hillside and call in, you know, air support.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was when I came back from Afghanistan, my son was actually born on November 30th. So I came back to a 4-month-year-old, beautiful, baby boy. And, I got recruited to the, training, detachment, we call it, which is our training command, and ended up, getting selected to go into we had an advanced sniper training program called a sniper cell, where we did a lot of test and evaluation, but also, did advanced training for the different platoon snipers. So we would do helicopter work, urban work, stuff like that. And then about that time, SEAL Team 6 guy, Bob Nielsen, came and asked if I would go down to the pilot sniper course. They were in the process of overhauling our 3-month-long sniper program, and he needed guys with experience. And so I went down there and was a part of that cadre that really brought our sniper program into the 21st century as far as modernization. We started looking at better ways to teach. And then I got asked to go down there as an instructor, which I did. And then a short time after that, I got put in charge as a course manager. So that's the head instructor.
So Brandon, you mentioned American Sniper, and I know Chris Kyle had joined shortly after 9/11. Did you ever cross paths with Chris?
Yeah, Chris was a new guy when I was at SEAL Team 3, and when I was just checking on board to the course as an instructor, he was just finishing his training down there. And then when I was a course manager, we would have guys back. We would invite guys to come down to the schoolhouse and share their experiences, so we could, you know, look at ways that we could improve the course. And Chris was one of those guys who definitely, you know, I remember Chris coming back and just kind of briefing us on what the current tactics being employed in Iraq and the urban environment and how we could make our own urban block of training better. And then, you know, him and I became friends outside of the Navy as well. A guy that I did grow close to, because we have an instructor-student mentor program, and many of your listeners may know Marcus Luttrell, who wrote the book Lone Survivor, and Marcus was a personal student of mine, and him and his twin brother, Morgan. So I got to be pretty close with Marcus, and it's just, you know, sometimes it's a little surreal seeing all this stuff unfold in the, you know, in the Hollywood pictures and the movies and stuff. But Chris was an amazing guy. It's just a tragedy what happened to him in Texas. And, you know, I know Marcus is out there doing really good things on the speaking tour. But still, you know, I could see it in his eyes. He's still dealing with a lot of grief with losing, you know, losing everybody on that hillside mission that he was on in Afghanistan.
We actually had Taya Kyle scheduled to be part of this broadcast, and unfortunately, due to an unexpected thing that had come up, she had to decline. Hopefully, we'll have her at some future point. It's time to take a break. When we come back, we're here speaking with Brandon Webb. He is the author of the current book, Among Heroes, U.S. Navy SEALs, True Story of Friendship, Heroism, and the Ultimate Sacrifice. We'll spend the last segment honoring As I understand, there are 8 specific people, profiles of people who you knew personally, who, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, gave the greatest sacrifice, the last full measure of devotion. We'll come back and honor those people right after these messages. Thank you.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
The latest business information is made simple with the Voice America Business Network. The professionals in the business world bring you live talk radio shows featuring an array of business topics, strategies for building wealth, sales and marketing, stock trading, investing, and business technology. Voice America Business hosts are professionals in their fields and bring to the airwaves weekly business discussions that offer up-to-date information, advice, and education. The Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business talk.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now. 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
This is The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. To reach the show today, call in to 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to scott@thebusinessofliving.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. We're here with Brandon Webb, and his book, Among Heroes, U.S. Navy SEALs, True Story of Friendship, Heroism, and the Ultimate Sacrifice, essentially provides 8 profiles of people. Brandon, as I understand it, you served with, you knew well, and gave their lives. I'd love for you just to give us a little bit of feel for each one of these individuals. So wherever you want to jump in, that would be terrific.
Sure. And I'll just start by saying I was inspired to write Among Heroes as I finished my first book called The Red Circle, which was my memoir. And I started getting calls from family members of some of the guys that I talked about in my first book and just thanking me for some of the stories I shared about guys like John Zinn, who was a friend of mine at Team 3 that lost his life in Jordan. Guys like Mike Bearden, his father called me up and said, thank you for sharing that crazy story of you and my son in sniper school. I would have never known. And it just dawned on me that, I was at a point in my life where I lost a lot of friends, more than the 8 in the book, Among Heroes. It was much more than that, but I had all these amazing friendships and combined with, this terrible loss of life. And these guys are just these incredible human beings. And there's so many stories that their own families weren't aware of. And so that inspired me to write the book. And, and some of the guys in the book, like Dave Scott, Dave was this incredible person, was an enlisted SEAL, and then went to the Reserve Officer Training Program. He was at, and I remember he was in D.C. going to college, and he did one of his final papers on terrorism, and he talked about a little known figure at the time, Osama bin Laden, and he had this whole theory on this emerging threat, and his his political science professor just kind of dismissed him, like, "Yeah, you're crazy. Like, what do you know? This is ridiculous." And you know, and you know, he basically called it, you know, years before mm-hmm. we were attacked, and you know,
and that was Dave Scott.
Yeah, that was Dave.
Yeah, in your book, that's an interesting, certainly an interesting footnote. You refer to him as the daredevil. How was Dave the daredevil?
Well, Dave's the guy that rode motorcycles and did base jumping on the weekends as a hobby.
So, right, just for kicks.
And that was long before base jumping was kind of even into the mainstream action sports circles. It was very dangerous at the time. And actually, Dave, it's how Dave actually ended up losing his life. It wasn't on a jump. It was he was climbing up a cliff and after a jump in Guam and actually ended up falling to his death. But just an incredible person, one of the smartest, funniest guys, and, you know, just natural daredevil. And, you know, what I try and convey in the book is, you know, try and connect the readers and make it seem like they get to know these guys. And I think they do by reading the book. And then look at the positive things how they influence my own life in a positive way, and try and pass those experiences and positive traits to the readers themselves. And that was my big objective there. And it's, I know we're limited on time and it's hard to get through all eight, but I would say I definitely want to mention Glenn Doherty, who was my best friend, and I lost in Benghazi, Libya in 2012. You know, Glenn, again, is just this amazing, amazing guy from Boston, was almost a professional skier, found his way into the SEAL team. Him and I served together, we're sniper students and a sniper pair together, just extremely close, in the SEAL teams and outside. We're both avid pilots. He's, you know, an uncle to my kids. And Glenn, kind of what I took away from knowing Glenn was just the love and care he took to, and effort he took to take care of his the friends and family that he loved was just exemplary in all aspects. I remember going on road trips with him, and he had this little black book, and he would just be making his way through the book, calling friend after friend. I mean, these are kids he grew up with in Boston, the guys that he skied with in Salt Lake City. And he just was able to maintain, like, in a very authentic way, this large group of friends. And when he, you know, it was in his will when he died that, you know, we're going to, he said, "I don't want a funeral." He's like, "Throw me a big effing party." That's all I want.
And by the way, there's folks, there's a great picture in the book just opposite page 179 of Glenn and our guest, Brandon. Two buff guys, too, by the way. Great picture. So was he killed as part of that, the Benghazi, what was at first at least reported to be, you know, some kind of a spontaneous action? Was that the same at that same time?
Yeah, same time. So he was a contractor working as a paramilitary contractor for the CIA, and the CIA guys put it on the line to go rescue the State Department personnel that came under attack. They were told initially to not go by the CIA chief of base, and
that's right.
And Ty Woods and the guys said, "No, we're going to go save these guys. If we don't do something, you know, these guys they're going to be dead." So that's just the kind of guy Glenn was. He was actually on his second trip to Libya. He did one tour there, and they were going to give him any assignment he wanted. But I remember having a conversation with him before he left. He said, "They need me there. I know I'm experienced, and the guys need me on the ground." And they were doing important work. They're trying to get the yellow cake uranium off the black market, as well as some other, you know, big weapons. And, you know, Libya still continues to be a failed state, but it was, you know, just dangerous stuff floating around out there. And, you know, Glenn was a guy that wasn't going to shy away from any action, or sure as heck wasn't going to shy away from helping his friends in need.
Yeah, you know, and this is not a political show, but I know you've been on many other shows. You have your own show, and I believe you're on the Sean Hannity show. But you know, with Hillary Clinton, you know, as the I guess you'd say it, the presumptive Democratic nominee, this Benghazi situation is going to come up and be even more scrutinized. I can only imagine. It just I don't know what your take is or was on that, but it just seemed like. Just a tragedy. I guess that's all I can say at this point. But doesn't seem like we handled that well at all.
No, I and you know what? I'm pretty down the middle politically, and for me, it just seems like there's this lack of accountability in D.C. across party lines. It's just, you know, on the Republican and Democrat side, and that's what disappointed me about Benghazi. It's not that I lost my best friend, which really sucks, but you know, look, those guys know the kind of situation and risks they're putting themselves in. To me, it's like, hey, bad things happen sometimes, but if we don't learn from our mistakes and start holding people accountable, and, you know, just what kind of example are we setting? And here's a situation where flagrant lack of attention around the security situation in Benghazi, the State Department people on the ground there just screaming for help. And nothing was done. It was just lost in the bureaucratic shuffle. And then after the fact, nobody held accountable. And to
me, not only was nothing done, but it was just spun so differently. We've unfortunately, we only have a couple minutes left, and we'll have to wrap up. But, you know, I'm just wondering with again, you profile in your book eight specific people, friends of yours who lost their lives. Now we look at the Middle East, we look at Iraq, we look at the ground that has been lost. They're knocking on Baghdad's door. In just a minute or so, you know, your thoughts on, you know, what should we do? Do we just walk away or what? What would you, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
So my thoughts are we don't have a clear strategy to deal with the situation, period. There's no clear strategic plan in place. So we have, you know, some of the best special ops troops in the world, very good at killing bad guys. But we're really, that's treating the symptoms of this radical Islamic movement. Yep, we can kill high-value targets all day long, but they're going to keep popping up if we don't look at the root causes. Like, what are the political, social and economic environments that are producing the terrorists of tomorrow, and really develop a plan to deal with it. And it's a long-term plan. It's going to take more than just America, but I think America can lead that, you know, lead the planning and build a coalition that really looks at this problem and recognize that it's going to be a long-term plan. And I think communicate that to America and the rest of the world. Like, hey, we've got a plan in place. This, you know, groups like ISIS and the terrible stuff they do and show on YouTube, it's just not going to be tolerated, period. And until we really get a plan, we're just going to be continuing to treat the symptoms of terrorism.
Floundering and giving up ground. Bren, we'll have to close now. I want to thank you so much for your service to the country. Thank you for your book and for honoring, you know, your friends. Please, folks, if you get a chance, as soon as you have a chance, the best thing to do is go to Amazon. It's Among Heroes, U.S. Navy SEALs, True Story of Friendship, Heroism, and the Ultimate Sacrifice by Brandon Webb. Brandon, again, thank you so much for being on the show. You've been listening to The Business of Living. Hope to see you again next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Living. Please join Scott Ventrella for another edition of the show next Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll see you here next Saturday.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.